Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, I'll be honoring the 50th anniversary of the pill by interviewing historian Elaine Tyler May about her new book on the history of the pill. Also, Oklahoma won't give up foolish abortion restrictions, and the frenzy over healthcare reform goes to the birds. The author I'm interviewing today is only one of at least two writers who've published books about the pill on the 50th anniversary of its approval as a contraception. Nancy Gibbs has also released a book, and she was on Morning Joe talking about it.
All through the 60s, you had to be married to get the pill. Even Planned Parenthood clinics would not give it to single women. Now, there were workarounds. You could borrow your friend's engagement ring and go in and claim you were about to get married. Or one college made girls bring a note from their minister testifying to their wedding date, and then they could get the pill. But the pill for the first 10 years, while we were, you know, seeing all of this great social change, was actually for married women.
Stay tuned for the interview later, because I'll be discussing this and other historically interesting issues regarding the pill with Elaine Tyler May. Oh, Oklahoma legislators, will you ever quit trying to come up with innovative ways to torture women for the high crime of being able to become pregnant?
In Oklahoma tonight, two highly restrictive abortion measures are now law. One requires women to undergo an ultrasound and listen to a detailed description of the fetus before getting an abortion. The second protects doctors from malpractice suits if they choose not to inform the parents of an unborn child that the fetus has birth defects. The governor had vetoed both measures last week, but today the legislature had enough votes to override those vetoes by the governor.
One of these bills can be described as rapish, which isn't so clear from this report. The ultrasound bill befits the perverted, hateful attitudes anti-choicers have towards women and their bodies better than pretty much anything I've seen come down the pike in a while. The law requires doctors not just to do an ultrasound, but a specific one involving a vaginal probe. Naturally, I immediately had anti-choicers arguing with me online that putting things in a woman's vagina against her will wasn't that big a deal if she had already consented to have other things put in there, such as the instruments to do an abortion. These people are wrong for two reasons. If you've ever had any kind of doctor poking around inside your body cavities, you'll know that your first major desire is to minimize the amount of time that this has to happen. This bill is about forcing doctors to put a probe in a woman's body for a period extended beyond what a doctor would usually do for medical reasons. Second of all, there's the issue of consent. I realize anti-choicers don't really get or respect the idea of consent when it comes to women, but this is not a small thing. If you don't consent to a specific invasive medical procedure, that can be traumatizing. Rape victims especially can have flashbacks if forced to be penetrated against their will. Doctors who have firsthand knowledge and control of the situation can work around this, but Oklahoma legislators don't care. Plus, saying that a woman consenting to abortion means she consents to having all sorts of things shoved in her vagina? That sounds a whole lot like rape apologists saying that you can't rape a woman unless she's a virgin. The governor of Oklahoma agreed that this was a gross violation of basic human rights, especially those of rape victims, who have a strong interest in having an abortion with as little invasion of their bodies as possible.
Victims of these horrific acts should not be forced to undergo a medical procedure against their will. It's unconscionable and it's unconstitutional.
The governor also seemed to be irate about the continuing insistence from the legislature that passing these laws is a good idea.
Governor Henry supports reasonable restrictions on abortion, but these bills went too far. They're unconstitutional, and the courts are going to throw them out.
The state of Oklahoma keeps spending hundreds of thousands of dollars defending these unconstitutional invasions of women's privacy and rights, and they usually lose in court. As I wrote at Double X, this is a poor choice, not just from a human rights perspective, but from a fiscal responsibility perspective. Oklahoma is facing a $1.2 billion budget shortfall. They really don't have the money to keep flushing down the toilet attacking women's rights. They have agencies to run and employees to pay first. I'd like to welcome Elaine Tyler May to the program. Elaine is a historian who works at the University of Minnesota, and she's been on the program before when she was researching her book on the pill. Now it's out, and it's called America and the Pill, A History of Promise, Peril, and Liberation. And she's here today to talk about her new book. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Elaine.
Thank you for having me.
I was interested to see that you had a personal historical stake in this subject, since your parents were involved in the early development and distribution of the pill. What role did they take?
Well, my father was a physician. His field was actually endocrinology. He wasn't in the field of OBGYN, but he was part of a growing group of doctors who were developing the field of reproductive medicine. And nearly all of these physicians were working along with scientists and other researchers to develop cures for both infertility and also methods of contraception. And these two aspects of their work were related, of course, in terms of the functions of the human body. Infertility and contraception both involve the same hormonal and physical functions. So these doctors were working together on both sides of this coin. And my father was one of the clinical researchers who used initially the compound that came to be the contraceptive pill. In the 1950s, he and many other doctors were using this combination of hormones to suppress ovulation, which at that time was used as a means to treat infertility with the theory, and it did work, that it worked for some women, that if they were having trouble ovulating or if their ovulation was irregular, if their ovulation was suppressed temporarily, then when the medications were discontinued, their body would rebound and they would ovulate regularly. So they knew that this compound worked to suppress ovulation, and they began to develop it with the possibility of using it for a long-term contraceptive pill where women could take it and they would suppress their ovulation for the amount of time that they didn't want to become pregnant.
That's really interesting. Do you know if they still use the pill to treat infertility in that way?
Well, probably in some infertility clinics, a variety of hormonal treatments, short-term treatments, might be used to stimulate ovulation. I don't really know much about that today. My father died in 1975, so I can't ask him about that anymore. But he and my mother both were very active in the birth control and Planned Parenthood movement in the 50s and 60s. They established some birth control clinics in the Los Angeles area, and my mother worked as director of some of them, and my father was a medical director.
I was recently, due to certain blog wars that are too tedious to talk about here, reminded of how much the pill attracts like fear-mongering and myth-making, and it always has throughout its history. People are afraid the pill is poisonous, that it'll undermine the family, that it'll make women something different than, like, well, women. How much do you think these kinds of fears shape the history of the birth control pill?
Well, you know, I find it fascinating that those myths and fears are still out there. They were certainly there when the pill was first approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 1960. And you've heard those accusations and claims and myths all along. And I think frankly, if we look at the numbers, millions of women have taken the birth control pill. About 80% of American women of childbearing age have taken the pill at some point or another in their lives. So I think these alarmist claims and these misrepresentations and untruthful claims have been part of a larger effort to restrict women's reproductive freedom, and they don't really have much of an effect, but they do have a political voice, and that's the real danger.
The pill was supposed to be revolutionary for women and really liberating them from the fear of unintended pregnancy. And it's, you know, certainly it's hard to even overestimate how much that probably plagued women before there was reliable contraception. Looking back over the past 50 years, how would you say that the revolution panned out?
Well, the revolution panned out not because of the pill. It panned out because of the feminist movement. It's certainly true that the birth control pill was a tremendous, wonderful improvement on other forms of contraception. Once the high-dose pill was revised and the hormone dosages were lowered, the pill became safer. It was certainly the most effective and most revolutionary form of birth control because it put contraception completely under the control of women. And it separated the act of contraception from the sex act. Those two things had never happened before. So now a woman could take the pill. She didn't need the permission or participation or even the knowledge of her sex partner. And the whole act of birth control would be removed from the sex act so that there would be more spontaneity and not so many interruptions and all of that that come with other kinds of barrier methods. So the pill on that level was, of course, a very revolutionary product. Now, in terms of women's lives, if there had been no feminist movement, that would have been it. It would have been a more convenient and a more effective pill. It would have been in women's control. But what the pill actually ended up doing was allowing women to take advantage of a lot of new opportunities opening up to women over the course of the post-World War II era. And that was because women themselves, through their own activism, were forcing open doors that had been closed to women in the past, doors to higher education and to jobs and occupations and careers, doors to activities in public life. The pill didn't open those doors. Women opened those doors, and the pill made it possible for the women to walk through them and to embrace new opportunities in their lives. So what the pill really did was it made it possible for women to have both a career and a family, which had been very difficult before. But the pill, because it really did allow women to predict and control their fertility, made it possible for them to do both. So when we think about the real revolution that the pill contributed to, it was a feminist revolution. It wasn't the pill that caused it, but the pill helped make it possible for women to take advantage of all of these new opportunities.
I think a lot of people don't necessarily know much about the kind of initial relationship between feminism and the pill. I think that a lot of people are under the misconception that the pill was just sort of invented by doctors and then feminists, like as if they never had anything to do with each other until it actually hit the market. But that's not true, if I'm correct. Can you kind of talk about what feminists had to do with the pill during the development stages?
Sure. We know that there were a lot of male doctors and researchers and scientists who did very important work in developing the pill, and I don't mean to disparage any of them. My father, of course, was among them. But it's also true that the first vision for a birth control pill was Margaret Sanger's. She had the idea as early as 1912. And in the 1950s, she got together with a friend of hers. They had known each other since their early days working in the women's rights movement and the women's suffrage movement in the 19-teens. The other woman was Catherine McCormick, who was a wealthy widow who had access to quite a bit of money. And Sanger and McCormick came together in the 1950s and decided to make the pill happen. And this was a time when pharmaceutical companies were very reluctant to put any funding into efforts at contraceptive research. It was considered somewhat unseemly. The government wouldn't have anything to do with it. President Eisenhower said, you know, this is something that the government should have nothing to do with. This is not our business. So no government agencies, not the NIH or the NSF or any of these government agencies, invested in the pill, and neither did pharmaceutical companies. They were investing in research, but not for the purposes of contraception. They were shying away from that. So Sanger and McCormick come together, and they find the scientists, and they together make this happen with McCormick's money. McCormick really bankrolled the development of the birth control pill, and very few people realize that. So without the efforts of Sanger and McCormick, their vision and their money, it's very questionable whether or not the pill would have been developed and marketed when it was.
So this is kind of an odd question, but see, you're clearly the expert on this, so I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Obviously, from the 1960s through, I'd say, the early to mid-80s, the pill was the dominant, like, ideal of contraception. But then, of course, AIDS came in, and now it's the condom, because it prevents STDs as well as conception. How has the pill fared, like, as number two? Like, how did it change it?
The pill is still the most popular form of contraception among young women. Interestingly, today, the most popular form of contraception for women in their early childbearing years is the pill, and for women in later years, after they've had the number of children they've wanted, or if they don't want any children or any more children, for those women, surgical sterilization is the most popular form of contraception. Now, neither one of those prevents against the transmission of STD or AIDS. So many of the young women who wrote to me in an internet survey that I conducted said that they actually use barrier methods. Obviously, that would mean the condom, as well as the pill, both for extra protection against pregnancy, but also, obviously, because the condom is really the only method now that is effective in preventing the spread of STDs. So you're absolutely right. The pill is not useful in that sense. It's only useful for preventing pregnancy. And as a result of that, it's not the perfect protection for the consequences of sexual intercourse, which are now, of course, not only pregnancy, but also very serious illnesses.
Did the women that you spoke to who used condoms still feel like the pill had the same kind of liberatory value that it maybe had in the pre-condom days?
Well, these were not interviews. These were emails that I received as a result of an author query. And there was a whole range of opinions and experiences about the pill. I can sum it up by saying that one young woman wrote, "I love the pill," and another wrote, "The pill sucks." So you have really that whole range and everything in between. So some women would say, "Well, I tried the pill, but, you know, I really didn't feel well while I was taking it, and I had all kinds of problems, so I stopped." Others would say, "Oh, I love the pill. It has, you know, completely liberated me. I never have to worry about getting pregnant, and, you know, it's the best thing in the world." The one thing that all of those young women had in common, whether they wanted to take the pill themselves or not, was they really believed very strongly that the pill should be accessible, available, and affordable, and there should be no laws or restrictions or conscience clauses or barriers for anyone who wanted to get hold of the pill or any kind of contraceptive. They felt very strongly about the importance of full reproductive rights for young women, and whether or not they themselves wanted to take the pill, they still believe strongly that it should be there and available for anyone who did.
My guest today has been Elaine Tyler May, and her book is America and the Pill, A History of Promise, Peril, and Liberation. You can find it online or at your local bookstore. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Elaine.
Thank you so much for having me.
I will say what you mean.
Healthcare. The bill passed and it should all be over, but you didn't think it would happen that quickly, did you? Now the opposition to healthcare reform has entered a phase that someone should coin a phrase for, perhaps involving the word post. Like how postmodernism creates a sensation of meta-ness and irony by going over the top. Post-healthcare reformism has a similar vibe to it. Surreal, but less playful. Things really got out of control when Sue Loudon, who was challenging Senator Harry Reid in Nevada, suggested that there was an idyllic past where people didn't need silly things like health insurance.
I'm telling you that this works. You know, before we all started having health care in the olden days, our grandparents, they would bring a chicken to the doctor. They would say, I'll paint your house. They would do, I mean, that's the old days of what people would do to get health care with their doctors.
Loudon was given multiple chances to play it off like she didn't mean it, but she refused. She's standing firm by the idea that we should be able to pay doctors in chickens instead of through insurance. As a commenter at my personal blog noted, healthcare reform opponents have gone from screeching about how doctors won't get paid enough in this system to suggesting that we should pay doctors in chickens. Anything but reform the insurance system, apparently. The parody started up immediately. I was fond of Progress Now Nevada, who posted Bring a Chicken to the Doctor, the dance remix.
To the doctor. Bring a chicken to the doctor. Bring a chicken to the doctor. I'm not backing down from that system. Let's change the system and talk about what the possibilities are. Bring a chicken to the doctor. Bring a chicken to the doctor. Bring a chicken to the doctor. I'm not.
Jay Leno had a good time of it.
She says one of the ways you can keep the cost of your health care down is to barter with your doctor. You know, trade with him. That's a great idea. But what if your doctor's not Amish? Okay, what do you do then? Okay,
then. Some of Harry Reid's supporters showed up at Loudon's offices carrying a goat and asking for a referral to a doctor who would accept it as a payment for medical services. To me, what was really funny about all this is that the sort of medical care that you could get in the 19th century or during the Dust Bowl period, which is the kind that was paid for in chickens, that kind of care was getting stitches and treating the common cold, the sort of thing that modern insurance pays for without squawking too much. In other words, people who could pay in chickens are the easiest to insure. It's the people who get things like breast cancer that have to worry.
The Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services calls the practice deplorable. Breast cancer patients are accusing insurance company WellPoint and its subsidiaries of dropping their insurance coverage soon after they're diagnosed.
Back in the bartering days, chemotherapy wasn't really an option. But let's just pretend that Loudon's got a point. Talking Points memo crunched the numbers and put the average cost of a chicken around $5. With some Googling, I found that breast cancer treatment costs around $35,000 on average. So basically, all you have to come up with is 7,000 chickens, which I'm sure your doctor will know what to do with. Stephen Colbert had some suggestions on how to make the system work.
Of course, you don't want to have to pay with the whole chicken. You might just need to make a small copay, you know, like maybe just the drumstick. I'm not gonna do it now. Don't worry about it, okay? And don't worry about the chicken if you have to do that. After you slice off the copay, just take him to the vet, and you can pay the vet with a parakeet.
What I loved about this whole chicken thing is how quickly it revealed how much right-wing nostalgia is actually pretty thorough. To my mind, living in the past where lifespans were shorter and you had to kill your own food sounds miserable. But I suppose right-wingers are willing to embrace all that if they can just get those old social inequalities back. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Anchor Baby Edition. When Arizona passed this law requiring police to harass people who they think look like illegal immigrants, I knew it was only a matter of time before women's reproductive choices got pulled into this. And sure enough, Fox News had this woman named Michelle Dallacroce on to shame immigrant women for having babies.
Whether they're here illegally or they're anchor babies marching down the street because they want their parents to stay in our country or in our state, you know, we've had enough.
This was after a rant where she implied that illegal immigrants were largely criminals and blamed basically all crime on them. There have been a number of attempts to criminalize or otherwise punish immigrant women having babies, and so this isn't the sort of thing we should take lightly.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.